Okay, next week is Christmas, and of course, that's normally the Thursday area, Christmas Eve, that Linda Moulton Howe is on with us. But because of the holidays, we've moved her up a bit. She's on tonight. She's on in a moment with some great stories, so stand by. And welcome back to Coast, Linda Moulton Howe finally back with us. She, of course, is a noted author, researcher. She appears regularly with us investigating some incredible, incredible stories. And we've got some tonight, some mysteries of the universe and some things that are happening right here on good old planet Earth. And I'm going to be with her in February at Big Bear Lake, California. I'm looking forward to this at the Alien Snow Fest. That's going to be great, Linda, isn't it?
I think so, too. And it sounds so fun. Whether they have lots of snow or lots of sun, it's really going to be fun. And I think that you and I and others are going to be talking about some very, very interesting aspects of phenomena that I hope a lot of people come to ask us questions and tell us their stories.
Indeed, indeed. Now, the first story you've been working on, we're going out into space. What is this?
Well, Ceres. Remember a month ago, I was reporting that the journal Nature had embargoed photographs of the bright spots in the crater when it got down to 915 miles above the surface.
Yep. Strange story.
And a lot of people were complaining and didn't think that was fair. But now everything seems to be coming out into the open. And after spending August to October at 915 miles above Ceres, NASA's Dawn spacecraft on October 23rd fired up its ion engines to start going lower another 675 miles. And in a couple of weeks, by Christmas, Dawn will be in its lowest and final mapping orbit of 240 miles above Ceres, photographing at a resolution of 120 feet per pixel. Not great, but it is at least as good as they've got right now. And in 2016, the engines will run out of fuel, and Dawn will then be a permanent but non-working satellite orbiting Ceres for the foreseeable future. Now, one of the dwarf planet's greatest mysteries has been, what are those big bright spots in the Ocotar crater north of the equator? Well, back at the end of August, new images from 915 miles above those bright spots that had been embargoed by the journal Nature pending publication, because this was a paper about what did spectroscopic analysis show that these bright spots might be made of. And finally, Nature published on December 9th a report by scientists at the Max Planck Institute for Solar System Research that the bright material is probably a type of magnesium sulfate called hexahydrite. And the hypothesis is that these bright, white, salt-rich areas, quote, were left behind when water ice came up, sublimated in the past, and the residual salt deposits would be exposed after asteroid or comet impacts, close quote. And the scientists say that at least 130 bright spots now have been counted around Ceres, and that because it's so global, they suggest, quote, that this dwarf planet has a subsurface layer that contains briny water ice, close quote. It's like Enceladus has an ocean underneath its icy surface. Well, believe it or not, this dwarf planet Ceres may have something like water underneath, but it means that there would have to be some kind of heat. Now, the Dawn spectroscopy also found that there are clays there rich with ammonia. And until now, ammonia clays have been more commonly found out in the Kuiper Belt, way beyond Pluto, in the kind of outer regions of our solar system. So does that mean that strange little dwarf planet Ceres began much further out and was somehow knocked inward to its current orbit between Mars and Jupiter? And does Ceres have a radioactive core that heats underground water ice to liquid that periodically erupts on the surface? And if so, could that mysterious 4-mile-high mountain, named now Ahuna Mons, be a cryovolcano that spews water ice instead of hot lava. And recently I talked about all of this on Ceres with Mark Raymond, PhD, Don Mission Director and Chief Engineer at JPL NASA in Pasadena. We began with the spectroscopic data suggesting that the bright spots on Alcotar Crater are similar to magnesium sulfate used on Earth for centuries as salts in bathwater to relax painful muscles. Hexahydrides have six hydrogen items, and here now from JPL NASA in Pasadena is Dr. Mark Raymond, director of the Dawn mission.
And this hexahydride, a different type of magnesium sulfate, is known on Earth as Epsom salt, so it's a naturally occurring material. And this apparently is produced from salt water, briny water, that made its way to the surface, perhaps by an impact excavates a crater and brings to the surface this briny water. The water molecules then sublimate, that is, goes from being a solid, frozen water on the cold surface of Ceres, to a gas. So the water escapes and leaves behind the material that was dissolved in it, that's the salt, and that material then is substantially more reflective than most of the rest of Ceres and leaves what amounts to salt flats.
In the images of Ceres that we've been looking at since the 1270 mapping orbit, there are craters all over Ceres. So why would there be this concentration of this magnesium salt only in this one Alcotar crater?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is that the analysis of the data so far seems to show that Alcotar is a relatively young crater. The estimate in this paper is 78 million years, which on geological timescales is young. And so the salt that's exposed hasn't been exposed long enough for it to be covered by subsequent impacts or otherwise modified to disappear into the background of Ceres. But the paper also points out they've now counted about 130 bright regions on Ceres. Alcotar is obviously the most striking, but there are many bright regions, and they all seem to be associated with impact craters, which contributes to the idea that it's material that's been excavated by these impacts.
But the very fact that the surface of Ceres is so cold implies that it must have internal heating that is creating liquid that could come up on the surface in the first place.
You're absolutely correct. There is likely an internal source of heat on Ceres, and this has been studied a great deal prior to Dawn's arrival, which is mathematical models of the process by which Ceres would have formed based on what we know about solar system evolution. Ceres would have incorporated radioactive materials when it formed nearly 4.6 billion years ago. And as those radioactive materials decay, they release heat. And so over the lifetime of the solar system, the decay of those materials would have provided heat to Ceres' interior. Then that heat would gradually work its way out to the surface, and then it would radiate into space. Now, of course, most of those radioactive materials by now would have decayed, but it takes a long time for the heat to move throughout the entire body and make its way out. And so that radioactive heating in its interior is indeed a source of heat, so you're quite right.
Does that mean that there could be liquid H2O underneath the surface of Ceres?
I believe that that remains a possibility, yes. So whether there's water in liquid or solid form will depend not only on the temperature, but also on the specific composition of the materials that are dissolved in it.
By Christmas 2015, Dawn should be at that 240 miles mapping orbit above the surface, right?
Right.
Will that be close enough to determine in real time, real images, if there is any kind of liquid coming from underneath the Alcotar crater into the surface that keeps replenishing these white, bright spots?
Well, the short answer is I don't know, but I don't think so. The resolution of the pictures there will be about 120 feet per pixel. I don't know whether that's enough to be able to see the kind of changes or other indications of real-time changes in the surface. Nevertheless, it is our intent to image a Kator crater multiple times while we're in this lowest altitude mapping orbit, and we certainly would look for changes.
Do you now wish that you had higher resolution in your camera?
Oh, well, you always want higher resolution. I mean, but the choice of the camera was based on our trying to make the first maps of these large worlds.
Let's move to the 4-mile-high, shiny, grooved mountain right next to a crater.
Ahuna Mons.
Why do you think that there is only one 4-mile-high mountain on Ceres?
I wonder exactly the same thing. I think that is a very good question. I have no idea what the answer is. Whatever those forces are, why did they only act in this one location?
Right.
I don't know. But I think that's an excellent question.
I'm looking at the shiny mountain photo, and it has striations or grooves coming from the top to the bottom very neatly, and there does not appear to be any debris at the base. What do you think is going on? What could have built or pushed up a 4-mile-high mountain on Ceres like this?
It is absolutely a fascinating and intriguing structure. It certainly looks somewhat like a volcanic cone on Earth.
Could there possibly be volcanic activity on Ceres? And if not, what could have the force to build something 4 miles high on a 600-mile diameter dwarf planet?
Well, that's the question that everybody wants to know the answer to. Same question that the geologists are asking. Now, even before Dawn arrived at Ceres, a phenomenon called cryovolcanism was recognized as a possibility there. Whether this is evidence of cryovolcanism or not is a key question that needs to be addressed. We talked earlier about the internal heat from Ceres working its way to the surface. It would be entirely reasonable if that caused volcanism. Is Ahuna Mons evidence of that?
But what would make all of the neat parallel grooves from the top to the bottom of 4 miles without any debris in the bottom?
I wish I knew the answer. I don't. And I don't understand what would have formed it and why it would look that way now. Streaks running down the sides, the geological analysis that goes with them, I'm sure will reveal whether there's reason to believe that the crater and the adjacent mountain are even associated. And one way to do that is to estimate their ages.
How do you do that?
The way they estimate the ages, which is how they estimated that a Kator is 78 million years old, is to count the number and size of smaller craters in any given region.
Does that increase the possibility that there could be some kind of bacteria or microbe or life form in the Ceres liquid underground?
I don't know. I'm not sure there's evidence that the ammonia is in liquid form. Ammonia is a molecule, one nitrogen and three hydrogens, that's bound up in minerals. So I don't know that it has to be liquid. It could be solid, that is ammonia ice. The presence of that does indicate additional ingredients that will tell geologists and astrobiologists about the biological potential for Ceres.
Right.
It's an intriguing possibility.
What is your own bias of hypothesis about whether it was pushed up 4 miles or it erupted up or?
That's a good question. I guess I would tend to lean a little bit toward pushed only because an eruption seems like it would, in Ceres low gravity, would leave evidence still farther away.
Have you studied what the physical forces would have to be to push up a mountain of ice 4 miles high?
Well, I have not. Whether anybody else has, I simply don't know. If it was pushed up, it doesn't have to be pushed up all at once. It could be a gradual process. Tens, hundreds, thousands, or millions of years for it quickly or gradually to be pushed up to that height. Just as we know mountains on Earth can take millions of years to reach those heights.
Yeah, but on Ceres, I'm assuming we're talking about an ice and water dwarf planet. And so the mind boggles at what force would make a 4-mile high mountain.
Well, that's right. And so it requires a quantitative analysis, but there are geologists on the team who will be looking into that. What is the composition of the bright material on it, and what's the composition of the dark material? You can't ignore the darker material because it's made out of both.
I get emails from people who say, well, I've worked in the mining industry, and this looks like a mountain that's being mined for something. What is the reaction of JPL NASA to that concept?
So far, we don't have any evidence, much as we would all like to or love to have it, of extraterrestrial intelligent activity elsewhere in the solar system.
In December, toward Christmas, as dawn is getting lower to a 240-mile above the Ceres surface, is the restriction on the pixel resolution going to hinder you finding out more?
These pictures are going to show about 4 times better resolution than the best pictures that we have so far. We'll continue to get more spectra. So the spacecraft will end its operations very likely in 2016 because it will run out of the conventional supply of propellant that we use to help orient the spacecraft in the zero gravity conditions of spaceflight. And so the spacecraft will stop operating, but it will stay in orbit around Ceres as the moon stays in orbit around the Earth.
And Dr. Raymond sent me a large map of Ceres with dozens of crater and a few mountain names that I have now at my earthfiles.com report that goes with this interview with Dr. Raymond. And I have it so that you can click on the image that is in the Ceres report tonight, and then it will go big, full size, and it's quite fascinating to look at the equator and see where the O'Connor crater is with the bright spots north of the equator a bit, and then to the south and to the east is this big 4-mile high mountain, Ahuna Mons. And it's very interesting to look around on this big map because you can also see some of the other areas, almost all of them where there have been some kind of a crater impact, that now in this big blow up that you can see these white patches that they say that there's 130 of them on the surface. And I think that this has been not only one of the most fascinating solar system mysteries that has been unfolding right before our eyes, that in spite of embargoed photos, we're now at 240 miles above the surface. And from December going forward, we should, as long as the spacecraft engine, the ion engine lasts and they can control it, we should be able to see really cool photos.
That's great. Now, Ceres is designated as a minor planet now, isn't it, Linda?
Dwarf. It's a dwarf planet, 600 miles in diameter. It's in the same category as Pluto. Pluto is a dwarf planet now.
That's amazing.
I know. And the relationship of what they're studying in the icy surface that they're seeing in some of the Ceres craters and what we have seen in Pluto, they are beginning to see that there might be some similarities, but that 4-mile high mountain on Ceres is truly an anomaly because it is the only one.
Baffling. Truly is something, but that tells you again the marvels of the universe, doesn't it?
Oh, I love it. I think that astronomy and studying not only our Earth, but the solar system and the universe around us is the most exciting thing you can do.
That event Linda and I are going to be at in February, the website is Alien Snow Fest, F-E-S-T, aliensnowfest.com. It's under my calendar at coasttocoastam.com, and in a few days we'll be putting it on our highlight section for you.
First weekend in February.
Looking forward to that. We're going to come back with more with Linda Moulton Howe. She's going to talk about the Paris Climate Change Group and what this all means in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Don't touch your dial. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. We're back with Linda Moulton Howe. Now, regardless of your views on climate change, whether you think it's an earth cycle, like I do, or whether it's man-made, like some of you do as well, we've got a report for you from Linda. Linda, tell us about what is going on here.
The earth is definitely warming. This year in 2015, the earth officially warmed 1 degree Celsius above the average pre-industrial age temperature back in 1850 to 1900. That 1 degree Celsius warming occurred in about 145 years, and that is very fast in Earth climate history. Many factors, both natural and human, can cause Earth to warm, including changes in the reflectivity of Earth's atmosphere and surface, variations in the sun's energy reaching Earth, and the buildup of greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide and methane from human industries and earth changes such as melting permafrost. Today, in December 2015, as the Paris COP21 climate accord was agreed on December 12th by nearly 200 nations, the goal now is to keep the 21st century world from rising another 1 degree Celsius. And that means trying to cap warming in the next 85 years at no more than 2 degrees Celsius by New Year's Day 2100. In Fahrenheit terms, that's a 3.6 degrees increase. Some scientists say Earth has only 15 to 35 years to reach zero net carbon emissions by 2030 to 2050 in order to even have a chance at keeping a cap at no more than 2 degrees Celsius rise. And that's going to be difficult because the so-called COP21 Paris Consensus Accord did not mandate how much each country must reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. There is no defined enforcement of punishment for nations that don't reduce greenhouse gases. China doesn't plan to start reducing its fossil fuel emissions until 2030. And there is no mandated guarantee that developed countries will pay for all or most of the economic burdens that developing countries face for shifting from fossil fuels to renewable energies. It is the speed with which Earth is warming that is so alarming to scientists and to the U.S. Department of Defense that says rapidly warming climate now, quote, poses immediate risks to U.S. national security, close quote, and could now be the greatest destabilizer of the 21st century. The Syrian civil war began because of severe drought that destroyed wheat crops, leaving large populations without food. World Bank President Jim Yong Kim has warned that Earth, quote, must not be allowed to warm 4 degrees Celsius this century because civilization will not be able to cope with the devastations, close quote. I learned recently from distinguished senior scientist Kevin Trenberth, PhD, at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, known as NCAR, in Boulder, Colorado, that he expects global warming to reach 2 degrees Celsius by 2050 to 2060, long before the end of the century. Dr. Trenberth is from New Zealand, but received his PhD in meteorology from MIT and has worked in atmospheric physics at NCAR since 1984. Here now is Dr. Trenberth from NCAR.
I agree that we have a serious problem, and the emissions are continuing to increase rather than decrease. And the 2 degrees Celsius number, I think we will certainly bypass that, probably around 2060 or thereabouts. But the time frame actually matters. So if we get to 2 degrees in 2050 as opposed to 2100, it makes a huge difference.
2 degrees Celsius in 2050, that is only about 35 years from now, so that the speed with which that would occur would not give the planet the ability to adapt, and there would be a lot more extinctions if we hit 2 degrees Celsius in 2050 instead of 2100.
Yes, the rates of change matter enormously. The doubling of carbon dioxide refers to the pre-industrial levels, which was about 280, so about 560 is what we're looking for in the mid-century.
Then, what are the consequences of getting to 2 degrees Celsius and 560 parts per million CO2 by 2050?
All of the energy infrastructure is very slow to change, and so there's a tremendous amount of inertia attached to that. And so if you start making changes now, to make any real substantial changes, it's going to take 20 years. And then the climate system itself responds very slowly because the oceans have a tremendous amount of inertia and only gradually warm up and respond to the emissions that are already in the atmosphere and what we call the concentrations of carbon dioxide. They have a very long lifetime, hundreds of years. And so what we've already got there now is going to continue to be there. And so even if we were to stop all emissions right now, we would still have what we've already got there, and that would still continue to produce some warming. And of course, we're not going to stop instantaneously. So even if we can slow things down in the next 20 years, we can see the climate system respond for another 20 years. And that's why I say that by mid-century, I think we're going to experience substantial climate change, and we could easily exceed 2 degrees Celsius by, say, 2060. And the reason for the focus on the 2 degrees Celsius is because that's about the kind of number where the changes are sufficiently large that current ecosystems are no longer viable where they currently are. And so this means for farming, for instance, you can no longer grow the same crops. You may be able to grow different crops, and you may be able to farm rather differently in terms of irrigation and fertilizer strategies and things like that, but you won't be able to grow the current crops in the same location. Things like managed forests, those trees will no longer be viable where they currently exist. They're not instantaneously going to die, but if there's a wildfire, new trees in that species will not be able to grow back in those locations. The fact that the trees are no longer viable in that location puts all of these ecosystems in jeopardy. That creates major dislocations of many kinds and has huge impacts that ripple through the natural environment, but also through society. And so the magnitude of the dislocations that begin to occur at that time are much greater than the ones we're already seeing today, and that's the real source of concern.
What would 4 degrees Celsius look like that the World Bank said would not be controllable by human civilization?
Temperature increases, and it tends to dry things out. So droughts set in a bit quicker. The droughts become more intense. The risk of wildfire goes up substantially. And so we're seeing that, especially in the western part of the United States, you know, all the way from Alaska through western Canada down into California, tremendous number of wildfires this past year. You're wiping out whole ecosystems and vegetation. The question then is whether some of those ecosystems can recover. On the other side of the coin is more moisture in the atmosphere. The rule of thumb is that for 1 degree Fahrenheit increase in temperature, the atmosphere holds about 4% more moisture. That's about 7% more per degree Celsius. By the time you're up to 2 degrees Celsius warming, we're up to something like 14% more moisture lurking around in the atmosphere. As a result, when it rains harder, so the rainstorms are more intense. The risk of flooding is much greater. So you end up with more extremes that we're already seeing, more extreme droughts, more extreme rain events, and these are very damaging for human infrastructure as well as for natural ecosystems. And I think water is going to be one of the biggest pressure points on society, and that will be substantial by 2050, 60, because there's only so much of it and the demand keeps increasing. And so then as you get to 4 degrees Celsius, then all of these things get locked into place. And so suddenly there are major changes in ecosystems. And I think at that point, you start to see major mass migrations and environmental refugees, and that increases the risk of conflicts. We're already seeing these kinds of conflicts and the kind of refugees that come out of Syria at the moment related to drought in that region. And this is why the Defense Department is very concerned that climate change is a major destabilization. It's an extra factor that adds into all of the other pressure points that occur in society. How that plays out, I think, is a major challenge.
Dr. Tremberth, if the Paris Agreement doesn't work and we warm up to 4 degrees Celsius by the end of this century, what would be happening on this planet?
I don't know exactly, but the worst heat wave you've ever experienced are apt to occur every year.
What happens to animals and birds and earth life?
Yes, well, some of them can migrate. Birds can move, but the light doesn't change. And the soils may not be conducive to that kind of thing. So if you're growing a crop in Illinois and it requires so much light, moving it further north means that in the middle of summer you've got plenty of light, but the season is shorter and the light conditions are certainly different up there. And the soil may not be suitable for the plants to migrate.
Already, the moose population around the Great Lakes states going to be extinct.
Yes, but the poster child for a lot of this is the polar bear and the vanishing Arctic sea ice. So that's one of the biggest threats that we can see already.
Okay, let me tick off what the World Bank in their report has listed as what they expect to happen at the end of this century at 4 degrees Celsius. Quote, by the end of this century, sea levels will rise by 1 meter or more as the ice sheets in Greenland and the West Antarctic melt, close quote. So that's the 3 to 4 feet right there in sea level rise.
I don't think that'll happen by 2100. There is one way to think about it is that if we don't do anything, then it might happen by 2300 or something like that. It's just a matter of when, not a matter of if.
But already in Florida, in some of the full moons, tides are coming into the streets of some of the coastal towns.
Yes, and that's correct. And sea level rise is already an issue. So in many places around the world, it's not just the fact that the sea level is going up. We're seeing sea level rise. But in addition to that, what is happening to the land? And in particular, there are parts of the coast that are subsiding. That's one of the factors when Katrina came ashore in 2005. In places like New York City, there is some subsidence of the land as well. And so the sea level rise there has been more like a foot. And so Superstorm Sandy was one that alerted the New York City area to some of the risks. In New Orleans, the Corps of Engineers has reconstructed many levees. I don't know that they have done them high enough or big enough or strong enough because I think they built it more to really resist a Category 3 storm, but they haven't built them strong enough to resist a Category 5 storm. And so there are many pieces of the coast that are extremely vulnerable, and Florida is certainly one of them.
It's my understanding from some other scientists doing computer modeling that the Mediterranean could end up with severe drought.
Well, certainly the Mediterranean is one region that does seem to be more likely to experience widespread droughts and associated heat waves. The poster child of that, I guess, is the 2003 heat wave that ended up killing some 70,000 people in France and surrounding areas. So these things are already happening, and I don't know that people have connected all of the dots to recognize that there is indeed a climate change component to these events.
But if we go to 4 degrees Celsius, then we have to face the urgency of trying to slow some of this down, because 4 degrees Celsius, according to this World Bank report, is what is going to cause these serious changes, in which ocean acidity will increase 150%, and that would kill the coral reefs and the Amazon rainforest.
Yes, that's correct. If these things happen, then they would be devastating, and we need to work to stop that. Even if it's 3 degrees, then a lot of these consequences, we would see a lot of evidence of those kind of things, maybe not quite as bad as the World Bank is putting forward, but it highlights the need to do something about it.
Would hurricanes and typhoons continue to increase in power and size?
Yes, a good example of that is what's happened in 2015. In 2015, the global mean temperature is the highest on record. A big component of this is the El Nino phenomenon. And so the heat that has been stored in the ocean for the last couple of years or even longer, a lot of that has spread across the ocean and the Pacific Ocean as warm as it's ever been. And there have been more Category 3, 4, and 5 storms than any other year on record. And there have been a number of really very big storms that caused local devastation that have gone into the Philippines, parts of China, Taiwan, and Japan, with major flooding events and strong winds. So the evidence certainly suggests that we can get more severe storms as a consequence of warming.
Now, in 2015, there have already been lists of climate anomalies. Starting with just a few, Australia as a whole had its warmest October this year of 2015 since national records began there in 1910. July 2015 was the highest temperature on record around the world for global land and ocean surfaces. Satellite images of the Pacific Ocean show warm surface temperatures that cover a larger area than the last huge El Nino of 1997 that caused so much flooding in California. Greenland's glaciers are retreating at least twice as fast as at any other time in the past 9,500 years based on research by Columbia University. And I think that all of this comes down to the summary that we are seeing great changes and that maybe this Paris Accord is sort of like the first, what we'll say, signal that all of the world is beginning to take this seriously because damages are going up every year in terms of the consequences of storms, drought, fires, flooding. And that's what the Department of Defense is so concerned about, that pretty soon the percentage of the money that is going to be going toward trying to cope with more Hurricane Sandys and all of the increasing fires that we've seen in the West will begin to take a bigger and bigger chunk, not just in the Northern Hemisphere, but all around the world. And that is why climate change, warming, is a destabilizer of our whole planet, not just the United States.
And times are changing, there's no doubt. When we come back at the top of the hour with Linda Moultonhowe, we're going to be talking about strange ways of communicating, different ancient and mysterious patterns. What the heck is all that about? We're going to check in with Linda on that and so much more. And don't forget our last hour of the show. It's called Conversations with Linda.